You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Well, Democrats are preparing to deal with something they have not had to deal with in about 8 years, a majority in the House of Representatives. I thought this would be a good time to catch up with some members of our Bay Area delegation, starting with the representative for California's 17th. That's a big chunk of the South Bay. Ro Khanna, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So I actually want to start with some of the last votes of this session. You recently had a motion to use Congress's authority under the War Powers Act to rein in U.S. support for the Saudi war in Yemen fail because of a procedural maneuver by Republicans. Our listeners probably already heard you explain at length what went down on Democracy Now. My question is, what do you think the prospects are for that kind of action in the upcoming session?
We will almost certainly introduce the resolution again in January, and I am confident that the leadership will bring it for a vote on the floor. Jim McGovern, who's the head of the Rules Committee, who will be the head, the Democrat, will certainly allow it for a vote. The challenge is every 10 minutes a child is dying in Yemen because of malnourishment. We still can't get food and medicine into Yemen because of the bombing of the port of Hodeidah. So every day we delay, there is more death and misery in the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
One of the remarkable things about this is how many Republican supporters you have picked up over the course of pushing this cause. What's getting through to them?
Well, one is the humanitarian aspect. The UN has a report that we may have 14 million people in Yemen face famine. That's a staggering number. In Rwanda, 800,000 people died. In Bosnia, 100,000 people died. In the worst famine in the last 100 years in West Bengal, 3 million died. So they are becoming more aware of just the sheer scale of the humanitarian suffering. Second, there is an emerging consensus among progressives on what I would describe as the Rand Paul wing of the Republican Party, who are skeptical of military interventionism abroad, who don't think that that has served the United States interests, who have pointed out that terrorism actually is more widespread after the so-called war on terrorism over the last 16 years, and they want more restraint in foreign policy. And so we are seeing this odd alliance, though a healthy alliance, between people in the Progressive Caucus and Freedom Caucus to restrain America's military interventionism.
So what do you think that bodes for the prospects of ending U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq and the more than a dozen other countries where we do drone strikes?
Well, it's a positive development, and we need to make sure now that we can convince the leadership. I mean, I have called for withdrawal of troops in Afghanistan. Our president, President Trump, had called for that as a candidate, and yet we continue to be there 17 years later. The Taliban now control 70% of Afghanistan. Just to put that in perspective, when President Obama ordered the surge of 30,000 troops, the Taliban controlled 40%. So we keep sending more troops, and we're losing to the Taliban. It's just unrealistic to expect that the United States will be able to usher in a new regime in Afghanistan. We ought to leave, and similarly, we ought to be leaving Iraq, and we ought not to be getting involved in Syria.
How much consensus is there within the Democratic caucus on that?
There's not consensus on that. I think that's going to be a issue that still needs to be debated and litigated. We are making the case for restraint. We're making the case that, yes, you should go after al-Qaeda. We can have, in certain cases, special operations forces engaged in making sure we're on the offensive against terrorism. But we ought not to have ground troops in 17 countries, including Afghanistan, engaged in war to try to change regimes of countries. That is not in our interest. And it has drained the American treasury $5.9 trillion since 2001 on these wars. Think about that. We could give everyone a free college education. We could have expanded Social Security. We could have increased the minimum wage to $15. We could have increased Medicare for all and coverage, and you still would have money left over.
So how much of an obstacle do you think the Republican Senate is towards, for instance, reining in U.S. involvement in Yemen?
I actually am optimistic about the Senate as it's currently composed. I'm hopeful Bernie Sanders will introduce a Yemen resolution in the lame duck. I think we could get some Republicans on our side. We had about 45 votes last time it was introduced. And you could see someone like Heidi Heitkamp or Joe Donnelly, who have nothing to lose now, supporting it. I have heard that Bob Menendez, who is a influential member on the Foreign Affairs Committee, is now sympathetic to a Yemen resolution stopping the war. He had voted against the resolution in the past. So there's movement. Now, what I don't know is what the composition will be next year, because we've had new senators coming. We have new senators coming in, Rick Scott in Florida and Josh Hawley in Missouri. And I don't know where they're going to stand on this issue. We have to get to them early to help inform them of what's going on.
Speaking of Ro Khanna, he's the U.S. representative for California's 17th congressional district. That is a big chunk of the South Bay. He's also been the person in Congress who has been doing the most work to move a resolution pulling the U.S. out of its involvement with the Saudi war in Yemen, pushing to move that ball down the field. Ro Khanna, I want to talk a little bit about the tussle that's playing out now over what the Democratic leadership will look like in the upcoming House session. There is apparently some controversy over whether Nancy Pelosi should return to the Speaker's post. First of all, where are you landing? And second, how is that playing out from your perspective?
Well, I support Nancy. What I've said is we won the majority because of accomplished women candidates, because of higher than ever turnout from women voters. And it would be a slap in the face to those who sent us to Congress to not give the gavel to the first woman speaker who led us to victory. So this idea that we should replace her and sow disunity at a moment of victory is just wrong. And look, Chuck Schumer is getting elected by acclamation, and he lost 3 seats. Nancy won 40 seats, more than anyone expected, there is an effort to deny her the gavel. I also think this is a manufactured issue. She has said she's going to be a transitional speaker. She has said she welcomes generational change. So let her lead. Let her negotiate with Trump. We need an outstanding negotiator there. And then let's pave the way in the next couple of years for succession.
The problem, as I understand it, is she doesn't just need a majority of Democrats to vote for her. She needs a majority of the entire Congress. Republicans
right.
would be unanimous against her. So it would take just a very few defections within your own caucus to scuttle it.
Correct. But I think it would be very difficult if she wins an overwhelming vote among the caucus. I think it would be very risky for a member of Congress to go vote against her on the House floor, voting against the first woman Speaker of the House on national television. That is probably not a vote that you want to cast, especially if you're from a safe Democratic district. And then there is the sense that some Republicans may vote for her. I mean, obviously, the president has encouraged that. I hope it doesn't come to that. But, you know, what I've learned with Nancy Pelosi is I would not count her out. And she seems very confident that she has the votes.
Ro Khanna, Democrats are going to have newly invigorated oversight authority. A lot of your colleagues will be able to unilaterally issue subpoenas to the Trump administration. What do you think are the most important areas for investigation?
We definitely first need to investigate executive overreach, separation of children from their mothers at the border. And the reunification of those families needs to be investigated. Many kids still aren't reunited with their parents. Why the delay? We need to ask those questions, and we need to push that those kids be reunited and that we never have that kind of inhumane policy again. We need to be investigating the assault on the independence of law enforcement, the efforts to interfere with the FBI investigation, with the Justice Department investigation, with Bob Mueller, all of that needs to be investigated. We need to ask for the president's tax returns and make that something that there is transparency on. So there are a number of places where Congress has oversight authority. It shouldn't just be about Trump. It needs to be also about checking executive overreach.
Do you think there's a risk of kind of losing focus, losing coherence, losing the narrative if you're just shotgunning out subpoenas in every direction?
Well, it's one committee. It's a government oversight committee. There are a lot of other committees in Congress which are going to be doing proactive work. We're going to be talking about Medicare for All, $1 trillion infrastructure package, $15 minimum wage, what we're going to be doing to expand universities across America, advancing NIH research. So there are about 15 committees in Congress. They all will be doing positive work. There are one or two committees to hold the president accountable. That's a critical function of Congress, but it shouldn't become the defining narrative.
A lot of those issues you just mentioned, clearly a Democratic bill is not going to get through the Senate on them, but you will have the opportunity to force votes in the House and put Republican representatives on the record taking yes or no positions on issues they've been able to duck for most of the last 8 years. What do you think are the top priorities?
Healthcare. I think we have to have a vote on Medicare for All. Half the candidates who won in these elections ran on Medicare for All. We need to make sure that we have a $1 trillion infrastructure bill. A friend of mine said we should call the bill Make America Great Again and have a $1 trillion infrastructure package and threaten the president to veto something like that. We need to deal with prescription drugs, the cost of prescription drugs. We need to deal with a $15 minimum wage. Senator Sanders and I successfully had a legislation, a bill that forced Amazon to raise their wage to $15. And just last week, we had legislation to force Walmart to raise their wages to $15. Let's see how that plays out. So these are the issues that I think have to be front and center for the Democrats.
Your top pick there was, or at least the first thing you mentioned, was Medicare for All, single-payer health care. This has been a dividing line within the Democratic Party. It's something that progressive Democrats have used to club moderate Democrats in party primaries. Do you see your caucus leadership ushering that to a floor vote?
I do. I think this is something that the base really wants. We know that Medicare for All is pro-job because it allows people to move jobs and not lose their health care. And moving is so important in current economy. We know that it's going to lower premiums and deductibles. We know that it's going to provide better coverage. So as a policy matter, it makes sense. We at least need to have a vote on it.
What about the issue of gun control? This became an unexpectedly salient election issue. After the Parkland shooting, a lot of people were motivated to run or to volunteer or to donate because of the perceived Republican intransigence when faced with the gun lobby.
You're absolutely correct. In fact, one of the most inspiring people who won, Lucy Macbeth in Georgia, she won the same seat, if you remember, that John Ossoff ran for in the special election a year and a half ago. She lost her son, her only son, to gun violence. She's in the Congress. She got a standing ovation from the entire Congress when she was introduced. But there are people who have come to the Congress where their biggest issue is gun safety. And these kids have changed the debate, the Parkland kids. I expect in the first 100 days, we're going to have votes on universal background checks, on limiting high-capacity magazines, on making sure that we have drug research, gun research as part of the Center of Disease Control. These are things, there are so many things that we need to do, whether it's healthcare, the environment, gun control, that our plate is going to be full in the first 100 days.
The conventional political wisdom on gun control for a long time has been, this is something that Democratic constituencies care about, but not enough to make them turn out in higher numbers. Whereas the Republican base will turn out to counter any perceived threat to gun rights. Do you think that political calculus has changed?
I do. I think it's changed because the electorate has changed. You have a lot more millennials showing up to vote, more millennials than ever showed up to vote this past midterm. You have more women showing up to vote. You have more minorities showing up to vote. So as the composition of the electorate has changed, the politics of gun safety and gun safety legislation has changed.
Also curious, as I said, you represent a chunk of Silicon Valley. Something that's kind of been simmering in both party caucuses, actually, is the question of what the government's regulatory posture should be towards the large emerging tech monopolies. There was just this huge investigation that broke in the New York Times about Facebook.
Right.
The worst allegation was Facebook hiring a Republican political consulting firm to basically spread conservative conspiracist memes about George Soros funding some of their critics.
Yeah, I know. It was a terrible thing to read and terrible tactics. You know, what I've said is that Silicon Valley needs to remember its foundational ideals. I mean, they were talking about ushering in the era of spring, about having a world that's more connected, that's supporting human rights. And now these technology companies are engaged in traditional politics and peddling opposition research. They're acting more like Lee Atwater than Vaclav Havel. So I would just say to them, remember the ideals of what you wanted to do with the world in terms of the flow of information and connectivity, and don't become a part of a system that you wanted to reform.
Right, but beyond moralizing in an interview with KPFA, which we certainly hope they're listening to, what do you think Congress should be doing? Should it be mulling over a new regulatory framework for these quasi-monopolistic tech firms? Should Mark Zuckerberg be getting subpoenas?
Well, I think that there needs to be a regulatory framework for data privacy and for making sure that people's expression, freedom of expression, is protected online. I've introduced the Internet Bill of Rights that goes a long way to do that, and having pro-competition platforms is part of that. One of the parts of the Bill of Rights allows you to move your data, and data portability would allow for greater competition. So I do think that Congress has a regulatory role.
Drawn a lot of fire from the right as well, because of alleged liberal bias in how companies like Facebook and Twitter enforce their terms of service, bar some right-wing conspiracists like Alex Jones, or just perceived bias in their algorithms about what gets promoted or what doesn't. Do you think there's room for like common ground with your Republican colleagues who've taken up those concerns? Or do you think they're kind of coming from a place that's so delusional that you're not able to work with them?
Well, I think the Republicans have politicized the issue. They're accusing these tech companies of bias, which is not true. I mean, the algorithms the tech companies are using are not biased politically. The challenge is these are difficult questions. How do you allow for the freedom of expression on online platforms and yet not allow hate speech, not allow speech that incites violence? That requires judgment, and the people who are making these judgments are often not First Amendment scholars. So what we need to do is thoughtfully think through a new paradigm for new media on how to have better speech, how to have third-party verification, how to understand bringing facts into the conversation. But I don't see Republicans engaged in that kind of conversation. They've politicized it by just accusing them of bias.
Finally, Representative Khanna, a question I know is a lot of our listeners' minds, because a lot of them write us about it. Impeachment. Is the House ready to move on it? If not, what are the steps before it is?
Well, it's on the table, but the Democrats actually believe in process, and we believe in evidence. How can you go impeach Donald Trump before Mueller has completed his inquiry? How can you go do that before you read the report and see, are there high crimes and misdemeanors? There are two different aspects. One is making sure that we convince people across this America that Donald Trump has had terrible policies that are inconsistent with our values. That has to be done. Community after community and state after state, and we need to continue on the midterm elections. There was a huge repudiation of Trump's policies in 2018, and I'm confident we will finish the job in 2020 and take back the Senate and the White House. Before that, what we have to look at is legally, are there high crimes and misdemeanors that the president has committed? And that's a judgment not just about Donald Trump. That's about our Constitution and our process, and making sure that process is never abused. And so I take that responsibility very seriously, and I will wait to read Mueller's report.
But that suggests the only things the president could be impeached over are the things that are within the scope of the Mueller report. A lot of what the president's done that seem like high crimes and misdemeanors, he's done in plain sight.
Such as where there's evidence? I mean, what would you say would be grounds for impeachment?
Well, first of all, there's all the emoluments issues with the businesses that he's kept up and running and transacting with foreign officials that have business before the United States government.
Right, and Mueller's looking into that. I mean, I know that that's part of Mueller's investigation.
Beyond that, there's everything from that the Trump administration's been slapped down by the courts on, from child separation to the Muslim entry ban.
Well, and those are unconstitutional policies that I am glad the courts struck down. But I think the cause for impeachment would be if the president then defied the court order. The fact that the president had policies that were wrong and morally wrong and repugnant, and that the court struck them down, is the functioning of our democracy. Now, if the president were to say, I'm going to ignore the courts and I'm going to still continue to separate kids from their children or ban Muslims entering this country in defiance of the courts, I think that would be a constitutional crisis.
Then there are the areas that are under the jurisdiction of the Mueller probe that are a matter of public record, like the president saying on camera, I fired Jim Comey because of the Russia investigation.
I agree with that, but I think we have to wait to see what Mueller comes up with and his findings on that, and whether he thinks there was obstruction of justice or not. I just think it would be a dangerous precedent to have members of Congress make those judgments before you have an independent counsel who's been tasked very, very much with the responsibility of doing so.
All right.
And I say this as someone who's horrified by a lot of what Donald Trump has done.
Representative Khanna, really appreciate your work. Really appreciate you taking so much time to speak with us.
Appreciate the interview.
Ro Khanna represents California's 17th district. That is a big chunk of the South Bay.